Maybe we should start with an apology about the audio this episode. I'm having mic issues, which is one of the hazards of remote recording. So
yeah,
enjoy.
we miss the days of being together in London and being able to do
Just being together, full stop.
Oh. And welcome to Drawing Blood, our podcast about the histories of medicine and science, the macabre, and art history and visual culture. I'm Christy Slobogan.
And I'm Emma Merkling.
And this is our final episode of season two, which we're really excited to bring to you. Our object of focus for today is a sculpture by Alfred Gilbert called Mors Genua Vitae, made roughly between 1907 and 1909, but commissioned in 1904 by Eliza McLaughlin to commemorate herself and her physician husband, Edward McLaughlin. And this is situated still in the Royal College of Surgeons of England in London. In this episode today, we cover a wide range of topics, including burial culture of the 19th century, particularly cremation. We talk about immortality, atheism, and unbelief in the Victorian period. We talk about relics, both secular and religious. And we talk about free love and sex. Yeah, we talk about sex.
Yeah, we talk about sex.
We're cool. We're cool podcasters.
I guess... Just as a reminder to everyone, we have a new and better way of finding the images we talk about. If you go to our website or swipe up and look at the show notes, you'll see a single link to a carousel of images that you can just swipe through, or on our website, go to the specific episode page and you'll find that carousel to stop you from having to click the links all the time.
Yay. So have we ever done a sculpture before? Have we done a three-dimensional?
Don't test my memory. Really violent.
We did the human remains episode. It was a contemporary sculpture.
Yes, which actually, as we will discover, is oddly applicable to today's subject.
That's a hint.
In keeping with the theme of the last few episodes, I feel like this is one of those episodes where it's an object that I've been thinking about for a really long time and haven't really had a place to go with it yet, and selfishly using Drawing Blood as a way to develop ideas for a potential article.
That's one of its purposes.
That's valid.
As well as just friendship.
Yes. And then I also thought that you would be, it's one of the episodes where I feel in some ways there's the most like immediate logical crossover for the two of us. Not least because the sculpture is in the Royal College of Surgeons. And I was going to start by asking, have you seen the sculpture?
Okay, so I'm really annoyed because yes, I did see this sculpture literally 3 months ago in May, but I didn't know that we were going to be doing an episode on it. So as I always do when I go to my archive, just a little bit of background, the book that I'm currently writing, its archive is housed in the Royal College of Surgeons. And so when I lived in London, I went there all the time and I always just would just walk by this sculpture. So I did the exact same thing back in May. I mean, I look at it a little bit because, you know, it's cool, but I don't really know a whole lot about it. So I'm excited and kind of kicking myself for not paying more attention to the lobby of the RCS or the Royal College of Surgeons.
So do you want to describe what it is? I'm aware that that's like a little bit harder actually when it comes to a sculpture, but I've assembled a bunch of pictures for you to sort of swipe through.
Yeah, and because I've actually been in the space, I think I can maybe try to describe it a bit more, even if I wasn't paying 100% attention. Like, I know what it feels like to walk around it. So the way that they've got it is you walk in the RCS and it's on the left, right next to the doors on the way to the lockers and the bathrooms. So it doesn't really have like...
prestige.
No, it doesn't really have a like pride of place. You know, pride of place is given to this massive sculpture of John Hunter, which is a like very typical self-aggrandizing like surgeon's portrait. and he's almost posed like the thinker, right? So you walk into the lobby and this sculpture, I believe it's a little bit taller than me. Is that right?
It's been, because the Hunterian was closed for many years, it's been years since I saw this in person. I think yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's about life size. I'm 5'8", and so it's a little bit taller than me.
Not to brag.
What?
Also 5'8". No, I'm joking.
It's just this 5'8½", if we're going to be annoying about it.
Okay, I'm not 5'8½".
Okay. And so I've seen it in the RCS. So it's this big sculpture. It's against the wall, as I said, on the way to the lockers and the bathrooms. It seems to be made of like green stone, maybe a little bit of red as well, and then wood and bronze. And then the thing that draws your eye immediately is this very textured portrait of a couple at the very top, right? Kind of have their arms around each other. And the very first thing that I thought of when I saw this years ago, and that I always immediately go back to from like my very first years of art history, is the like Etruscan couple tombs. So there's one called the sarcophagus of the spouses. That's very similar, where like the man is a little bit higher than the woman and he's got her arm around her. There are a couple of other visual similarities, like almost even in the like shape of her weird hair, that I'm not sure what's going on with this couple in this RCS sculpture. But like the Etruscan woman also has this headdress and then like flat hair coming down. And so that was just my immediate like visual comparison. Obviously wildly different context, but maybe something similar.
Definitely overlap. I do have Etruscan tombs written down in my notes.
Oh, great. So we'll, okay.
For more reasons than one.
And so this couple on the top, which I think maybe we'll focus on throughout this episode, but it's very like textured. The bronze is so modeled, like you want to reach out and touch it, right?
It almost looks like clay, like black.
Yeah, it looks like clay. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, and another thing is that, so they're on this kind of plinth, but it almost reads altar because it's got these insets. They've got, it looks like a frieze. I don't know what's depicted on these bottom insets of the plinth, but almost looks like a frieze, which you might see as like a predella or something in an altar in a church, and then other scenes within the front. And they're on top of that. And then they're also holding hands, this couple, you know, under their big, gooey, like very modeled cloaks that they've got on.
I love gooey cloaks.
Gooey cloaks. There's just so much fabric, bronze fabric. And then he's kind of holding this box, which has a mix of decorative and figurative work on it. You've got maybe angels on the top corners, and then you've got what looks like a baby angel on the top sleeping, a cherub, something
new
like that.
New art history term for Cupid just dropped. Baby angels.
This is public art history, Emma.
There's a pair of baby angels embracing and lying down.
So it's a pair. So I don't think I realized that it was a pair. Okay, so we already mentioned Etruscan tombs. This looks like a tomb in miniature. And, you know, the fact that it's a child, the fact that it's a Cupid, like, is it a tomb for a child? Is that kind of what is happening here? Like, I know from the themes that you kind of prepped me with before that this is like about death. So I assume that this is a memorial of some sort.
Yeah. So it's super interesting that you mentioned the idea that this might be a child, that there might be commemoration of a child going on here. We'll definitely circle back to that. Victorian reviewers also thought the same thing. And I'm guessing that you're thinking that because of this couple, right? You know, this like mother figure, or this woman and this man who are embracing and cradling and looking down at this tiny little miniature tomb.
It's giving tragic nuclear family.
Yeah,
is definitely.
It's giving like Victorian death.
Yes, it's giving Victorian death, which I think is what it actually is. So
you said that you don't really know what's on these panels. That's because the modeling is quite gestural and even a little bit, I would say, like symbolist. Like I'm thinking George Frederick Watts. I'll link to some paintings by him. As you said, there's this symbolism of love throughout, and sort of, I guess, death in a very broad sense, like angels and cupids. And yeah, so we will talk a little bit about what those figures are, but I think it is just worth stressing off the top that the reason you can't really see what they are is because they're so sort of suggestive and murky. And I actually would argue that that applies to the symbolism of the whole thing, right? It's about love, but the consistency of the iconographic program is something I think we'll get into.
Great.
So let me tell you a bit about the sculpture. And I just want to say, actually, I meant to say this off top, but I have a bunch of thanks for this episode. I'm currently doing a fellowship in Italy, so I'm not in London anymore. So I have to thank Charlie Ponzio, Harvey Shepherd, and Damia Chniewice for going truly above and beyond in being my research assistants for this episode. And then also to Claire Stainthorpe, who is a brilliant scholar and was super helpful for me in untangling some of the themes that we will be talking about in this episode. So let me tell you a bit about the sculpture. It is a memorial. I mean, it's surrounded, like, if memory serves, by a bunch of portraits. I don't remember if they're sculptural or not, but, you know, portraits commemorating, I presume, important figures from the history of the Royal College of Surgeons. And it's, I don't know, I find it quite an incongruous object in this space. Like, as you said, it's like huge. It's off to the side. It's a couple.
Can I show you this one picture that I found while I was doing a little bit of research about the RCS?
Please.
It is a picture of the lobby. So it's this sculpture in situ with the bust portraits and other portraits that you were talking about. It's in a book from 1967 called Artistic Possessions at the Royal College of Surgeons of England. This sculpture, not mentioned. Gilbert,
amazing.
Not in the index. Not privileged at all. But this picture, it shows the staircase in the lobby from the inner hall, and it lists who the portraits are that can be seen in this photo. And the way that this photo is constructed, there's a massive pillar right in front of the Gilbert sculpture.
Incredible.
It's just like, nope, this doesn't matter at all. Like, you can see the edges of the bronze
in
this photo from 1967, but it's like, nope. Christy came to this book to look for more information about the sculpture that Emma was going to tell us about, and she is thwarted again. But I find that really interesting.
It is. And I think it has to do with kind of what this object is. So the sculpture was commissioned by one of the subjects of the bust. So the bust shows Eliza McLaughlin and her husband, Edward McLaughlin. And the reason it's in the Royal College of Surgeons is because she donated it to them in his memory. And before she did that, she almost said emailed. She wrote to them. We're talking 1905, by the way. 1904, 1905. She wrote them to offer an endowed scholarship in the name of her husband, donating a shit ton of money to the Royal College of Surgeons, of which I believe he was a member, but he wasn't a fellow. But her husband was a physician. He was a general practitioner, I think, from Lancashire. And his wife is really like the main character. And I mean that in every sense of the word. But after she offers the scholarship and they accept, she offers them this sculpture by Alfred Gilbert, who is a really important artist. So it's also not like the most annoying of bequests to get, mm-hmm. right? And it's a sculpture that is of the pair of them in commemoration of her husband. And she also donates the whole Italian marble floor that you can see in that picture. So the memorial actually is in the picture that
wow.
you showed me.
Wow.
And it's signed with her name.
The floor?
The floor is signed.
Oh, she is so extra. I love it.
I know. Anyway, before I tell you more, I want to say that the sculpture is also their final resting place. It's a cinerarium. It's not just a sculpture. It's a reliquary.
So their bodies are literally in the RCS.
Yep.
Both of them?
Yep. In the little caskets. In the tomb.
In the thing that he's holding.
Yes.
And cinerarium, so meaning cremation.
As ashes, yes.
But oh my gosh, that is... That is so weird, though, because it is literally just on the way to the lockers in the bathroom, and it's like, I mean, a grave.
This is why I'm obsessed with the sculpture. It's so profoundly weird in the best, like, most drawing blood way. Also, it's not a memorial to child, and that will become relevant for reasons we'll go into later, but you're not alone in thinking that. When it was displayed as a plaster cast in 1907, it wasn't said that it was a memorial to Eliza and Edward McLaughlin. It was just like,
okay.
Their names were not mentioned. And so it was taken to be just be like a symbol of love, and the person speculated, sort of as you did, that it was for a child.
So the two cupids kind of embracing on the top of the mini tomb, is that more representing like this couple's love rather than a child?
I think so. And really what the sculpture is it's just like, it's a testament to their devotion and to their love. And that, I have to say, like, having gone through the letters, and the Royal College of Surgeons also has a book of her unpublished poems, which are, I want to say unhinged, but she also had mental health issues. So that feels like, do you know what I mean? But
yeah.
But like unhinged respectfully, you know?
Yeah, I think I do.
I'll read you some. I got permission to quote from them. And yeah, so like a lot of the symbolism, as we said already, is like love based. And it has one of the panels at the bottom is of Eros. And we'll sort of get back to that as well. But yes.
Wait, I don't think you finished the thought there. So you were saying like you've read some of her poems and things, and do those like prove to you that they really were in love?
Yeah, the devotion really comes through. She's clearly devastated after the death of her husband. Mm-hmm. I was actually going to read this at the end, but why didn't I read it now? She writes one of her poems. They're just really sad. Like mm-hmm. she clearly was like very much grieving. So she says, "Our life, not to part till death, not even then, finished. Dead in the same grave, sweet contact here, our ashes and thine, near and more near." And so this theme of like perpetual contact, which is both in the sculpture that Gilbert created and in the mingling of their ashes. And mingling is the word she uses. She says in her explanation letter to the Royal College of Surgeons, she has super clear instructions, you know, "My husband's ashes will go in there. And then when I die, I will be cremated and my ashes will be put in there. It'll be locked. You'll destroy the key because we want to mingle forever."
Morbidly adorable.
I know, right? I definitely want to go back to Alfred Gilbert at some point and tell you a bit more about him. I mean, he's just one of the most famous sculptors of the Victorian period. He does a bunch of like royal commissions and stuff, including a lot of funerary sculpture, which is interesting, I think. Mm-hmm. And his earlier stuff is quite different from the later stuff. I love the later stuff. It's all like the body's like buried in decorative excess. So I've just sent you a picture of another one of his works from the turn of the century. This one's called The Virgin.
So we were talking about how Eliza McLaughlin was extra, and I'm seeing a lot of extraness in Gilbert's sculptures as well.
Gilbert was also extra.
Very extra, like lots of excess, lots of crusty, gloopy, lovely, you know, material in his sculpture.
Yeah, and we'll come back to Gilbert later. He is an important part of the story. But yeah, let's talk a little bit about Victorian death first. And also, I guess this idea of the sculpture as cinerarium. And yeah, I wonder if you have any ideas about that. And like, I mean, you're an art historian. Like, what does it bring up for you?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing is the fact that this is a material object that includes someone's body or like parts of their body obviously makes me think immediately of relics and like the history of relics.
Let's talk about relics.
Okay. So the thing about this, if you're thinking about this as a relic, right? So I was raised Catholic as well. So relics are a big deal. But this is a secular relic, right? This is not the bones of a saint, or it is not. I mean, so you've got two different kinds of relics in Catholicism. You've got first class or primary relics, which are the actual body parts, which we can kind of think about this as a first class relic of this relationship. And then you've got second class or secondary relics, which are things that came into contact with the body and can include like blood, sweat, and tears, right? So if you think about like cloths that wiped Jesus's face during his stroll. His stroll up to be crucified. So like the cloth that would have wiped Jesus's face on the way to the crucifixion, that would be qualified as like a secondary or second class relic. So a relic, these primary or secondary relics were used historically in the Christian world, early Christian world, up through today, really, for veneration, for intercessional purposes. So like you can pray to the relics in order to these body parts or these second class relics to intercede on your behalf, to make your life better or to heal somebody. And then they also were often thought to have healing qualities or being able to have miracles happen, right? They were miraculous objects.
Now, and you're saying Christian, but definitely in Victorian Britain, Catholic is the important thing to stress.
And, but this Catholic history of relics grew out of the pagan world as well. You know, in the pagan world, it was often the hero's body parts or remnants of, you know, important men that then kind of got taken up and repurposed by Christians and Catholics eventually to then be the body parts and the secondary relics of saints and martyrs.
This entwining of the pagan and the Victorian is something that I think is just going to keep coming up throughout this episode. We've already seen it, right? With the like Cupids or the general gesturing towards love or even Eros, you know, in the sculpture so far.
Absolutely. But it's really interesting in the Victorian era, these very obviously religious body part, you know, this idea that, oh, body parts, relics have this kind of almost magical quality within the framework of religion. But in the Victorian period, secular relics became a thing. And so that's what we're looking at here, where it's like the relics are no longer this person who means a lot to so many people. The relics are instead this personal thing, this secular thing with the body part of one person, or in this case, two people who mean a lot to a much smaller group of people, often only one person. So if you think about like cutting a lock of hair off of someone, a child who's just died, putting it in a locket, that was really popular in the Victorian era. And that's an example of a secular relic.
And we will link to some of those because Victorian mourning jewelry, Victorian hair jewelry is incredible. Do you know the William Morris one?
No.
Oh, it's one of my favorites. I'll send it to you.
And we'll link to that in the show notes, the William Morris one. Okay, great.
Yeah. And I just want to clarify, you mean like in Deborah Lutz's definition of the secular relic, right? Because secular means a lot of different things, but she is just using it to mean not like, you know, the Victorians are still on the whole believers in the afterlife, churchgoers. And so, you know, not secular in the sense that like divorced from religion or divorced from the church, but just meaning like not by the, like, it's not a Catholic, it's not the bones of Mary.
Right. The bones of Mary, who famously did not leave any bones as someone who was in Catholic school for 9 years. But yes, exactly that. And I'm definitely using Deborah Lutz's book to kind of be thinking about this today. And it's this idea that like this object, this piece of your loved one who is deceased could revivify them or like keep them active in your life.
Well, it's about touch, right? It's about like physical proximity. Yes. I mean, it's about like, it's this interesting, very, very Victorian thing where it's like, they're obsessed with death. I mean, if you even think about Victoria, like one of the things that everyone knows about her, that she's like always dressed in black, that she's always in mourning.
And that's mourning for her partner, Albert.
Yes. And so like this intertwining of death and love is like super important for the Victorians. There's this shift. I mean, there's a lot of writing about this, a lot of really,
Well, and would you also say that like in the Victorian period, and once again, this is your area of expertise, but would you also say that like the spiritual becomes particularly material, like corporeal, and you can see that in secular relics or no? Or
yes, just with things like spiritualism, like materiality, matter is really important for the Victorians. And we've talked about spiritualism on previous episodes, but yeah, this intertwining of the material and the physical, but you know, there's a reason that spiritualism becomes so big, right? And it's with the rise of positivist science, with the rise of new theories of matter, comes this concomitant set of religious beliefs that is also about spirit as being material in the world. And as you're identifying, I don't think that's separate from this practice of carrying like books bound in skin of loved ones, like hair in lockets held close to the heart.
And it's really interesting. Deborah Lutz talks about this at the end of her book. And I found it fascinating as someone who looks a lot at photography and like its materiality and its relationship with the body. But she says it's almost paradoxical that like the fever pitch of when these secular relics were so widely used is also when photography became widely used. And so you would think that photographs of loved ones would start to supplant the secular relics at that point.
But photographs don't touch.
Exactly. Yeah, they're not material enough.
Yeah.
They're not material enough. So that doesn't start to happen until the 20th century, you know, after the First World War, when people wanted to be separated from the bodies a little bit more that were, you know, rotting in these battlefields and they'd seen all the horrible things that can happen to bodies. That's when photography began to take over these secular relics.
I will make a slight corrective, which is that the thing that's very Victorian is this joint disgust about the corpse and more specifically, actually, not disgust about the corpse perhaps, but disgust about the rotting, decaying body. Disgust about, you know, like, I don't think we mentioned transy tombs, but I thought about that in relation to the Gilbert sculpture. Do you know what a transy tomb is?
No, please explain.
Transy tombs are like, I think, medieval tomb types in which you have, as part of the funerary imagery, a rotting body. Like, I'm going to send you one.
Wait, you mean like you can see it's like an open casket thing?
No, it's a sculpture. It's a memento mori.
Oh, okay. Maybe I should have, but no, I've never seen one of these before. Or so, maybe it hasn't registered. This is incredible.
In Philippe Arias's book, The Hour of Our Death, which I did not prep for this episode, but I was so obsessed with it in my undergrad that I feel like I remember its argument by heart. I don't even know if it's still like considered relevant or good scholarship. But he basically traces this massive shift throughout time in like this massive history in how people treat their dead. And so whereas in sort of this like early modern medieval period, the body, like you see this a lot in cemeteries and stuff. It's here lies the body of, like, the dead body doesn't, you know, whatever. It's not the person you love. Their spirit's already gone. Mm-hmm. But by the Victorian era, there's more of an intermingling or association of the body with the beloved. And that's why Victorians bury their dead like as if they're sleeping. There's like this, a lot of like metaphorical language emerges, a lot of tombstones that are like sacred to the memory of. But what that also means is that there is nothing that feels more horrifying than the thought that your loved one is decaying. And so I haven't read Deborah Lutz's book in ages, but I imagine she talks about this. I imagine that's not divorced from the practice of keeping things that will not decay, like hair or,
right,
I guess, treated skin, like vellum. And, you know, people are buried like in nightgowns. The tombs are like lead so that the seeping, putrefying, oozing stuff doesn't like seep out of the coffin and you don't have to see it. But yeah, I was just saying, like, the distancing from the rotting corpse is already happening. And I think that like some of that language, we'll get back to this, I'm sure, but like, don't you feel like the language of like the cemetery or decay is somewhere in the Gilbert, like with those terrains of fabric? And like, actually, if you zoom in, there are little things that could either be mushrooms or people.
What did I call it earlier? A gloopy cloak.
Exactly.
I mean, if you bury someone in a cloak, it's going to be gloopy real quick. So I think I can definitely see that language in there, which is interesting because like throughout the 19th century, you can kind of see, I mean, not to be overly Whiggish or anything, but you kind of see this progression of laws that further scientizes and makes cleaner the burial process. So like you've got cremation, as we said, at the very end of the 19th century and the early 20th century happening more frequently and like happening here, as we said, in the Cremation Act of 1902 that allowed for crematoria to be set up. But the move to cremation kind of echoes earlier movements in the 19th century from the churchyard to the more genteel cemetery. And you've got like the two main reasons to move from burial to cremation or from the churchyard to the genteel cemetery. Like think of Highgate in London, right? Like this kind of luxurious, like very big space for one body per grave, you know, like clearly separated. But the two reasons for these movements to like a more scientized or more aestheticized or more hygienic, like a hygienic death way, right? The two reasons are religious independence. So like doing something that is not sanctioned by the church or not like run by the church, or the reason of hygiene, cleanliness, and security from body snatchers. Like obviously if you're cremated, your body's not going to be snatched by surgeons, like many of the ones who were fellows at the RCS, to then be dissected to teach surgery and anatomy.
Incredible crossover.
Thanks.
But yeah, I mean, basically, I think this issue of, we don't have time to go into everything. So I think this like issue of hygiene is a really useful one. And also just like in the mid-Victorian period, there is a massive problem with like overcrowded graveyards.
Yep.
And these cause like major public health problems in cities. People are obsessed with miasma, which, you know, they think is like the scent and the smell and just the circulation in the air of rotting corpses is unhealthy.
It can get you sick.
Yeah. Exactly. It can cause damage to the body. I just wanted to give you like, I feel like maybe I've waited a little bit long now, but I wanted to give you, before we really get into cremation, the other big reveal, which is that the McLaughlins weren't religious. In fact, they were atheists.
And
atheism is the one thread that runs entirely through their relationship, their writings, her letters to the college. In terms of this memorial, she says of her husband, he was an atheist, and so am I an atheist. And it is in that name that I have to memorialize him. Sorry, immortalize him.
Immortalize. So when I was saying like, oh, angels, you know, I was thinking like religious sculpture mode, but I guess it's more mythological sculpture mode. And like
I guess, but one of the big question marks I have about the sculpture, and maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves here, is that there is a very curious relationship between atheism or unbelief and spirituality that I think is kind of, that is definitely left unresolved. And I guess the main place where you see that is the title Mors Janua Vitae, which, do you know what it means?
Death?
Yes.
Life. Death and life.
Death is the gateway to life, or death, the gateway to life.
Gateway, I would not have gotten. Got it. Okay.
And if that sounds very religious, it's because it is. Like, it's a very spiritualist specific. Like, Evelyn de Morgan has a painting that has Mors Janua Vitae written in the corner. I don't know if we're going to have time, but let me show you one other painting called Mors Janua Vitae.
Okay, great. I think that's helpful. Okay, I see the painting.
You want to just describe it briefly? Like, very, it's just super religious.
It's super religious. Is he a knight? Yeah, he looks like a knight in armor kneeling in front of an angel with a halo who is opening up a curtain to the light. So assuming that means like afterlife, like he's following her into another life.
Yeah. And he's like maybe in a cemetery. It's kind of unclear.
Yeah. It's very dark background.
Yeah. And it's got to do with ideas about very immortality, right?
Yes. Very different vibe from the Gilbert sculpture we're talking about. But you just said immortality and like that's exactly what it's achieving.
Exactly. And I guess this question of like an immortalizing sculpture to people who fundamentally did not believe in, as far as I can tell, in an immortal afterlife
right.
is really interesting, I think.
And for sure.
Yeah.
But I mean, it also, like you're more likely to get cremated today if you're not, you know, particularly religious. So that makes sense to me at least.
Well, I think, so cremation was still very much associated with atheism or just unbelief broadly in the 19th century, not exclusively, but secularism, free thinking, atheism, you know, there's a broad range of, I will tell you a little bit about the history of atheism, but in the broad range in the spectrum of Victorian unbelief or Victorian secularism, let's say, you know, basically by more mainstream Christians, cremation was often condemned as like a practice which, firstly, because it's like of pagan origin, is incompatible okay. with Christian faith. And Caroline Kosach actually has a new book that's coming out that's going to be dealing with some of this stuff. She's going to be looking at secularism and cremation, among other things, and basically tracing also its concept back to like the secularism of like the French Revolution and the Italian Risorgimento, which is sort of what it comes out of. And then in the 19th century, like cremation sort of merges with this discourse of hygiene as like a cleaner and more aesthetic, yes. which I think is interesting, and more hygienic death. And it's sort of, it is one of those things that has, I think, as you say, maintained its secularist tone. So like not everyone who cremates themselves are atheists, but a lot of right. atheists are, yeah, supporting cremation and also like derogatorily identified with it by Christians in the 19th century.
Yeah, it's interesting though, tying cremation also back to what you said earlier about the mingling of their ashes that she mentioned in their poem, because one of the issues that religious people in the 19th century had with this move towards more scientific burial, where, you know, you separate each person, is that that didn't allow for family graves. That didn't allow for people to be buried on top of, next to, right inside the same tomb or the same burial with their loved ones. Whereas in a way, you know, this, the McLaughlin's cremation allows for that to happen again. So it kind of, by becoming the most scientific, it subverts the scientific process of burial. You know what I mean?
Well, and it's interesting, just thinking about, you know, the aspect of Victorian spirituality I specialize the most on, which is spiritualism. There's this real emphasis in spiritualist thinking of the integrity of the soul after death. You know, this idea that the soul must maintain its edges, that it doesn't get dissolved and mingled with other souls. And
interesting.
As far as I remember, I didn't look this up before the episode, but as far as I remember about 19th century death, that's also something that's a concern, right? That the body in some understandings has to be whole. The dead
you
body
for
has
Christians?
To be whole. Yeah, to get into heaven, yeah. which is also why they were so scared of grave robbers. And
yes.
So right, cremation is like, you're completely dissolved.
Exactly. Because in the second coming, Jesus is going to call for all the righteous to come out of their graves. And if you're ashes, you can't then climb out of your graves and go up to heaven with Jesus.
As a sidebar that I'm hoping we don't have to cut, because I mentioned paganism and cremation, do you mm-hmm. know about my favorite 19th century character, Dr. William Price?
Dr. William Price. I don't believe I do.
Please hold for a photograph of Dr. William Price.
Ah! What is happening here? Who is this?
Oh my God, I'm so glad you asked. So Dr. William Price, who was a physician, was also a druid.
Ah.
And he was an extremely notorious character, like very eccentric Welsh physician in the 19th century, who sort of went viral when he got caught burning his son's body in a barrel, dead son's yep. body in yep. a barrel of petroleum. And he was arrested. And it was a big moment for the sort of cremationists, because he was saying that he was practicing old druidic pagan rites of cremation.
Right.
And
what year was
people
this?
Around 1884, maybe 1883.
Okay, so way before like the Cremation Act that I mentioned earlier. Like
yes, but the first crematorium opened, I think, in 1885 in the UK.
Got it. Okay.
So, but yes, it is right. Like as you, it's one of the things that, no pun intended, fueled the fire. You know, lit a fire beneath the cremationists, shall we say? But I guess all I'm saying is it's just interesting, right? That once again we have the merging of the pagan and the secular on who are meeting on this issue of cremation.
And meeting in the form of a medical man or like
yeah,
a medical
yeah.
figure, which is
who was also a healer. Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, I guess this gets me into, I wanted to tell you a little bit about Victorian atheism, because I didn't know anything about it before this episode. And thanks again to Claire Steinthorpe, who just like talked me through all of this in her spare time. You know, I think just because you've already brought up sort of like modern atheism, one of the things that my instinct going into this was, I don't know that modern atheism and Victorian atheism were as alike as we might think on paper, right? And
yeah,
the reason I say we might think it on paper is because there's this myth of the crisis of faith, right? That the Victorian age is where suddenly, because of Darwin, there's this rupture and you have agnostics emerging for the first time and, you know, all this other stuff. Not only is that narrative like extremely reductive and not entirely true, mm-hmm, but in the spectrum of unbelief, let's say, as like a broad umbrella, or secularism in the 19th century, there were quite a few figures, and I knew of Annie Besant personally, but there were quite a few figures who, you know, she started her career as an atheist and ended as probably the most famous theosophist who ever lived. Theosophy being one of these like late Victorian occult, heterodox spiritual faiths, which does believe in like a soul and an astral body and astral projection and the afterlife and communion with spirits.
And when you say she started her career as an atheist, you mean she was like a writer, a philosopher? How do you mean?
All of the above, really. She was a very famous public figure. She was extremely important for, along with her, I think, then partner in 1877, Charles Bradlaugh, and they were both avowed atheists. She got put on trial for republishing Charles Knowlton's Fruits of Philosophy, which was a pamphlet about birth control.
We love birth control.
Well, here's the thing, that the tradition of like secularism in the 19th century, it emerges in the 19th century out of these like anti-clerical and radical roots that go back to the 18th century. And I think in the early 19th century, it's sort of emerging as this strand of rationalism with this guy called Robert Owen and his followers, who are called Owenites, believe that abolishing religion is absolutely fundamental to a new moral world. One of the things that I found truly radical and really exceptional about the free thinkers and the people that I was looking at for this was that their philosophies actually align pretty closely with what we consider to be extremely radical and progressive thinking even today, even along the abolish the family lines, which we'll get to a little bit later. We will talk about free love, which is one of the things that comes out of this movement. You know, I already mentioned the Owenites, but then there's this guy, George Jacob Holyoake, who sort of coins the term secularism in the 40s and 50s. And then Charles Bradlaugh, who was the guy who got tried with Annie Besant, sort of emerges in the 1860s. And he's a bit more radical. He says like atheism, no belief in God, is like central to secularism. Atheism is always the most extreme, is usually the most extreme, most radical form of this. I guess what I was trying to say was in the less radical groups, like in the not Bradlaugh sort of area, space is made for people who do maybe have some theistic views, but are looking for a moral system outside of religion, you know? But yeah, I mean, I guess what they're basing it in, I guess the argument is this, that there is a human morality that is before religion, that it's not what, you know, religious doctrine tells you, which is like morality comes from faith and comes from the church, but that there is like a natural human morality. And it's all about living a moral life and how to live morally without religion. You know, because the afterlife isn't the important thing, the radical thinking is grounded in making this world a better place. So it's generally about human improvement, improving the conditions of the poor, improving the conditions of women, you know, making the world that we live in now a better place. And that morality being central to how one lives one's life.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
And one of the things that especially the feminist free thinkers draw out is they look to the Bible and they look to contemporary problems, which includes the abuse of women, the selling of women as chattel into marriage. Annie Besant becomes one of the first people to talk about marital rape.
Okay.
Birth control among the poor. Like one of the core tenets of free thinking is like people should have access to knowledge. People should know their bodies. And they see as one of the problems of the Bible, this idea that like Eve is subservient to Adam. All original sin begins with Eve. They have a real issue that all the talk doesn't mention sexual pleasure and doesn't mention anything about like that sex is nothing other than to procreate, like all of this. We'll get back to that later because I think it's relevant. But
so were the McLaughlins, so the subjects of this sculpture, were they part of this group, this atheist group in the 19th century? This free thinkers group?
So they're explicitly atheists. And it was extremely controversial. So I'm going to tell you in a second about Edward and Eliza McLaughlin's writings, on atheism, but in her, in a memorial she wrote to him, she said, she writes this passage where she calls him a born surgeon. And she says, as he was beginning to practice, infidel was shouted after him by people in the street. His dog was nicknamed McLaughlin's little unbeliever. The windows of his surgery were smashed.
I see. Okay. So atheism was like a big part of his public identity. Like people knew that this was his belief or non-belief, I guess.
And he actually describes, interestingly, what you said, he describes religion as a disease. And this is a quote, which destroys all that is lofty and noble and truthful in exact proportion to the intensity of infection and literalness of acception. Acception, is that a word?
Acceptance.
It might be my transcribing.
Or it could just be him. But okay, that's really interesting. But once again, these kind of like medical metaphors or medical men like talking about religion in this way.
Totally. And one of the things I think I've found in researching this is that Edward McLaughlin published three things, two of which are really important to our conversation. Mm-hmm. And he published, among the things that he publishes in the Provincial Medical Journal in 1885, he writes this article, which is largely about birth control. It's called The Fruits of Philosophy, which is the name of that publication that Besant, I mentioned, republished.
Right. Yeah.
And he says in it, he says explicitly, it's sort of a rebuttal to someone else's argument in the same journal about it. So not all, nowhere close to all medical men were secular. He says, we are not at all disposed to defend the present institution of marriage. What can be more obvious than that sexual love is indispensable for the complete and perfect happiness of the normal and healthy individual?
Love it.
And he has a lot of more specific views about birth control. He says that retraction, which I guess is the pull-out method during intercourse, is injurious, especially because it interferes with the due occurrence of sexual orgasm on the part of the woman.
Okay, that is not where I expected that to go. I thought it was going to be the man's orgasm, or that it would be injurious too. Awesome.
So this is the thing about a lot of free thinkers, is that because there's this complete rethinking of the tenets of morality, and because it's against this biblical view, which is based on a hierarchy of the sexes, there's a lot of support for rethinking, you know, sexual relations between people, rethinking the bonds that people form. And in fact, the McLaughlins didn't get married until 5 years before he was about to die. And
really?
It was a matter of principle, she says in her writings. And actually—
So they were just living? Were they living together or—
Yeah, I think they were living together.
Cool.
But in the spectrum of unbelief, there's like a lot of, you know, some people thought there should be marriage, but it should be changed. Some people were more about advocating for like divorce laws and, you know, women to be able to get out of the situation. Some people, and they embraced infidel as a term, which is the most based shit I've ever heard, you know, really advocated for for free love and for unions between men and women that were founded just on a promise to one another, and that could be relinquished when there was no love anymore.
Yeah, but I also like that using the word infidel also plays on infidelity and like relating belief to sexual relations and kind of this loosey-goosey free love situation. I love it.
And I just want to say that Laura Schwartz's book, Infidel Feminism, is a fantastic resource in all of this.
What a great title too. Love it.
Okay. So the reason that all of this matters a little bit to do with, I think, some of the stuff we've been talking about. Like, they didn't have a child. Mm-hmm. And there's a slightly cryptic line in her memorial to him. And before I read this to you, I will warn you that her writing is very impressionistic, shall we say. So okay. I had to read this like 8 times before I understood it. But okay. So from her memorial to him, she says, atheist, socialist, idealist, a martyr to principles. He will not be married. He has her, meaning Eliza, promise that she will be all in all to him. She does not know what this means, but he will teach her, and delicately, so sex. He will be her husband in the best and truest sense. It would be a crime to let her have a child. And then she goes on, now he is hopelessly ill. 5 years before he died, he cannot endure it any longer not to be legally married. And promise me you will give what you have not spent of my earnings at your death during your lifetime when you can spare it to surgery.
Hence the bequest for the scholarship to the RCS.
Yeah. I get the impression, and I might be wrong, but it might also help make sense of this sort of confusing memorial. I get the impression that he's a bit more like atheist TM, unflexible in those beliefs than she is necessarily.
Okay. Yeah.
She writes about the soul in some of her poems, but it's not the Christian soul. She calls him God a few times, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think she published this, but still, you know, like, but This thing, it would be a crime to let her have a child.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting, but I think it means that they just practiced birth control. There's no context, so I don't know what.
Of course, yeah, it's hard to say. Yeah.
And the reason this matters gets us into the other sort of big reveal about this sculpture.
So many big reveals in this sculpture. I love it. If the sculpture that I've walked by so many times in my life. Ugh.
Which is that as Richard Dormant, who's like a big deal and like he wrote this, like, you know, writing about sculpture in like the 1970s, you know, says it's actually in many ways a testament to an eternal ménage à trois.
Okay.
Because Eliza had an affair with Gilbert while he was making the sculpture. Just wait. And it was by all like accounts, a really torrid affair. I mean, Gilbert by this point has split with his wife. He's not doing so good. Like he's basically bankrupt. And the affair ends like terribly and he like refuses to finish the sculpture. So actually the sculpture that you see in the Royal College of Surgeons, he doesn't claim is finished. He writes a really angry letter to them where he's like, it's not finished. And instead her friend Albert Toft, the sculptor, I think cast in bronze for
Interesting.
Her.
Interesting. Oh my gosh.
But more than that, there is a hinged cavity in her head where Gilbert's ashes were intended to be stored. So this was going to be like a monument to a throuple.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Talk about free love and, you know, as you're saying, like feels very radical.
No, but like I think it's relevant to what we've been talking, you know, that's, I said that the child thing would come in to play later again. And I think it's just like, I do think it's related to the sort of loosening around some of the strictures around the relationships that you can have with people. And also, I think that the British Library's copy of McLaughlin's writings is actually the one that Alfred Gilbert owned because it's inscribed in the front to Alfred Gilbert, our friend, from Eliza McLaughlin. So wow. He is involved. He is intensely involved in the like love. It is a throuple. Like
even if
he's dead, you know?
Yeah. And sorry, this maybe isn't exactly a segue, but I'm just thinking like the absolute audacity, the gall, the gumption to put that into her head. Did she know that he was doing that?
Yeah. She wanted him.
Oh, okay.
He was meant to. And then, I mean, she basically says.
That's another argument for why it's a throuple because it's involved. It's not like he just foisted his ashes upon their scenario.
Exactly.
Okay. I see.
And she basically says, I can't find the exact quote right now, but she writes and says that like, yeah, his ashes were meant to be in my head and still are if I can get there before his children and like his executors. And she couldn't. Firstly, this was also written before they broke up. So maybe she didn't want them anymore.
What a wild, wild story. That is just batshit bonkers.
When she's writing to the Royal College of Surgeons, she says, when my encouragement and commission reached Alfred Gilbert, his answer to me was, I envy you your memories. Stay by me, for it is only your strength that will make me work and keep me at work.
She's so extra.
I know. But anyway, this just gets me into like the last thing I wanted to talk about that I think brings all of this together. And it's the panels on the bottom of the sculpture.
So those are the panels that I said made it kind of look like an altar to me.
Yeah. So let's talk about the imagery. You have in that frieze, which you described sort of like an altar. And now that we've done a little bit, I can say that to me, it reads, yes, a bit like an altar, but even more like a Roman temple, like one of these more pagan, you know, with the columns and everything. So along the top, you have this almost like, not quite Bacchanalian, but let's say Bacchanalian frieze. That's just like a bunch of bodies sort of like dancing around. And in the center is the sort of little Cupidic figure.
Okay.
And at the bottom, you have one figure. Do you want to describe the three panels and what you can see?
So the two side panels look almost like they could be the same person, but from the back and from the front, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, those are the narrow panels at the side, and those are both just one singular figure. Maybe the figure on the left is like stepping up and the other stepping, I'm not sure. And then the middle figure looks like a female figure winged.
Yeah, I think another sort of Cupidic.
Yeah.
And there are sort of faces floating in the ether. I mean, the imagery is super spiritualist to me, which is why I find this very confusing as an object. But those two figures, the nude figures, one of which is walking into what looks like flames, don't you think? That they're these like.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's the one I was talking about stepping up. Yeah.
See yes, that? With
yeah.
the cremation
yes, of
stuff
course.
Makes it extra interesting. So he has two figures, one stepping into the source of fire and one stepping out of it across a threshold, which also is giving this like death, the gateway to life thing.
Yeah.
But the figures stepping across, which if it was spiritualist, you would think are like souls or, you know, whatever, are labeled as Eros and Anteros. Do you have a sense for what Eros and Anteros are?
I only know this because of the sculpture in Piccadilly Circus, but Eros is...
Which is by Gilbert.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, I had no idea. Amazing. Okay, so Eros, I believe, is sexual love or just love, and then Antiros is requited love.
Yes, Gilbert has a slightly different interpretation. In Gilbert's understanding of this, and he gives a very useful interview about this in, I think, the 20s, for him, it's about generative and destructive love.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And he says that he saw his own life in terms of this. So he's also sort of putting himself into the sculpture, mm-hmm, which makes it mm-hmm. even more sort of like menage à trois.
He literally wanted to put himself in the sculpture as well. Yeah.
So Gilbert says in this interview that he saw his own life in terms of a struggle between Eros and Antiros, which for him represented passionate, destructive love and pure, ennobling love.
Okay, so that's the requited love is the pure, ennobling love.
Antiros. Yes, I mean, I don't think it quite maps him. I'm not sure it entirely maps on. But he calls these his ego and alter ego. And Richard Dorman says we can think of this more like his id and his ego, right? That the destructive side of his personality pitted against the creative. And, you know, I think like it's very tempting to biographize this object, partly because I think it is so biographical.
Yeah, it is.
But, you know, it's tempting to think of his affairs as merging these two again, right? That it's this destructive thing that like really fucked both of them up, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And that it created this beautiful monument. And I keep coming back to sort of the child and perhaps lack of a child and this question of immortality, right? Because for atheists, the child is in many ways like your only or one of your very few sort of sources of real immortality in the sense of like living on. You know, she says immortalizing. Yeah. And so the sculpture, the child that reviewers saw in it, you know, is the sculpture the child? I don't know. I'm just saying that like these things about like, and it's quite queer in that sense. And like, I don't know, like, well, we don't have to get too much into queer theory, but basically this, a testament to a love that is non-reproductive.
Yeah. It reads nuclear family, but it thwarts it in every way.
Exactly. That pushes against like conventional romantic and familial structures that is defined as an object in its story by extramarital non-reproductive desire. The creation is the act of art, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that makes a lot of sense to read it through that kind of queer theory alternate family structure lens. I think that's really cool.
And just sort of trying to think of the sculpture as like a memorial object, right? Like that creation, and especially Gilbert's, we didn't talk about lost wax casting, but you know, his method, which is sort of like piling stuff on, it comes from his sort of goldsmith's training, right? You saw that other sculpture of his that I showed you.
Yeah.
This creation, this building up of matter as a way of like counteracting decay and dissolution, and that they are immortalized by virtue of being this solid fucking bronze object embedded in a marble floor in the secular resting place of prestige, right? Like the Royal College of Surgeons.
And I think, so you just said like this accumulation of material for immortality. It really, I mean, like I said, I've spent a lot of time in the Royal College of Surgeons. And so RCS itself is so committed to this idea of profuse accumulation in order to account for the immortality of the surgeons who are fellows there. But like, I write about this, these archives in the RCS, right? For example, one of the artists that I write about, I was in the archive in the RCS and I was looking at one of her sketchbooks, which is one of many surrounded by so many boxes of stuff. And she wrote in one of her sketchbooks, like, never throw anything away. Like, this is an aphorism that all of these plastic surgeons use, like, never throw anything away, keep everything, blah, blah, blah. Turns out she lifted that from one of the surgeons themselves. He was talking about, like, body parts, like, never body parts away during surgery because— Like the relics, like, never throw body parts away because you don't know if you're going to need it in another surgery. Like, keep it on ice. But it also so applied to, like, their idea of never throw anything away that relates to your surgical practice because— you're going to need it in order to be revered, to be this like relic of surgical greatness, right? And to show how much this like necessary for the accumulation of memory and immortality of surgeons is still so important. There's this 2016 history of one of these groups of surgeons who keep their archives in the RCS. And the archivist, hobby archivist, essentially, he said, quote, "Think of the instrument you invented or the photograph at the bottom drawer of your desk and let the archive know, because obituaries are rarely written and published now, so people who have contributed to the development of our specialty will be forgotten if you don't like keep accumulating these things for immortality." So it's basically, I mean, it's a more modern version of like this fear of losing relevance and of being forgotten, right? And so the RCS in the sculpture, in the micro, is all about immortality. But the RCS as an institution itself, even though they say, like, we are for the education of future surgeons, like, we are for the betterment of the treatment of patients, it really is also about immortalizing the surgeons who are fellows, the whole building.
Well, and one thing, I mean, I think that really works, but one thing I really like about the Gilbert sculpture, and maybe this is naive, but I, you know, the fact that it went, you know, she really, like I said, main character, like, really fought for this thing to be there. And also immortalizing the both of them and them as a couple, because clearly also their partnership was so generative for his work. You know, she writes, publishes his writings after his death, like, does this thing in his name, but also that it fits, I think, within this long line of secular and free thinking Victorians' efforts to do good. And I'm thinking of the scholarship in particular, and, you know, the leaving of a legacy and the immortalizing in that sense as well. Okay, it's, do you need a fuck off big bronze sculpture to do that as well? Maybe not, but yeah.